Welcome to Sacred Legions. I'm Max Kohler. John Russell is a high school English teacher and debate coach at Sumner Memorial High School in Sullivan, Maine. Kurt Vonnegut said in an interview, "Teaching, may I say, is the noblest profession of all in democracy." Welcome, John Russell.
Thank you.
So I want to start out first, I guess, with you are a debate coach, and that has been a core of your teaching for a long time. You really focus on making sure that you have the opportunity to take your students into debate and all that. Can you tell me how you got started in that and why that became a particular passion of yours in your teaching?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, my whole life I think I've enjoyed the idea of debate and public speaking. I think I've always wanted to feel like I could hold my own in a discussion on a topic of some importance, and that I could stand up in a room, in a meeting, in front of a group of people and say what I need to say in an effective way. And so when I got to high school many years ago, I went to Yarmouth High in Southern Maine, suburb of Portland. And I found out that my high school had a debate team. I was there on day one, and I did a lot of activities in high school, and I was a fairly committed student generally, but I really can say without any exaggeration that the debate team was my favorite thing I did, and I think the most meaningful and beneficial for what actually was going to come after. And that's including every class I took, just that experience of competing in that way, especially as someone who does so much public speaking in my job. You know, I'm standing in front of students talking every day. It just was a really powerful way to prepare for that. I didn't pursue it in college, which I kind of regret. I actually don't even know if my college had a team. I think I was kind of exhausted and wanted to focus on my academics. And then when I got back into teaching, I was overwhelmed by that. And so I always thought, maybe someday I'll coach speech and debate, but I probably would have put it off forever. However, about 5 or 6 years into my teaching career, I took a job at Yarmouth High School, my alma mater. And in the 13 years since I had graduated and since I was rehired, the team had fallen apart somehow. And so there was no speech and debate team at the time. However, there were a couple upperclassmen who wanted to start one. And the vice principal told them, hey, we just hired a new English teacher who actually was on our team back in the day. He might be your guy. And so, like, literally first week of school, I'm, you know, drinking out of a fire hose, trying to catch my breath. And these two very poised young men appeared in my office and made the pitch. And my kids at that time were very young, probably like 4 and 2. And so I was a little reluctant just in terms of the time commitment, but it was very difficult to say no. And so my wife supported me and I started doing it. And it's probably the best professional decision I've ever made. By this point, it's by far my favorite part of my job. I like to joke that I teach English now so that I can coach speech and debate. So yeah, I just haven't looked back since. Even though I've moved schools twice since then, I've made it a priority to be part of a speech debate program at both of those schools, which has been no small task because neither school had a speech debate program. So it's been founding two programs in addition to the one that we rebooted at Yarmouth.
So there was no speech debate. I know that you were in a school down in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that a little bit too, but was that the program that didn't have a speech and debate? And then I think your current high school that didn't have a speech and debate to start with.
Correct. Yeah. The school in New Mexico, Navajo Preparatory School, they had had a team a few years prior. It was a pretty informal operation. It was sort of like, let's have a team and compete occasionally. And then it had fallen apart during the pandemic. So while they had had a team before, they never had a team on the level that I kind of wanted to bring one there. I wanted to me, I really feel like speech and debate can hold its own with any athletic event, with any sport in terms of the level of commitment that it can merit from students and the rigor. Of course, it's not physical rigor, although there are some events that are quite physical, the speech side especially has a lot of acting adjacent events that can really require some pretty impressive physical prowess. And honestly, a lot of the greatest actors and comedians and directors working today got their start in speech and debate, often in those, they call them interpretation events. So anyway, yeah, I wanted to make sure that the program was as full-fledged as it could be. Not because, I mean, for me, like medals and national qualifications, things like that, those are exciting. But I want to make sure, I felt really benefited by my time on the team as a kid. And I've seen in my coaching career how beneficial it can be for students. And so I don't want to deprive kids of any opportunity they might have to gain some of those benefits. And so that causes me to coach the team. It's a whole hog sort of thing.
So not knowing much about speech and debate, can you tell me what different categories your students are working from? Because I did have some exposure to it when I was teaching. I think yep. I judged some of the local speech and debate things at high school. But I seem to remember there's a lot of categories that your students can compete in.
Yeah, depending on the tournament, there can be as many as 15 or even 20 different categories of speech and debate. Generally, it's closer to 10 or 12 for at least local circuit tournaments. But regardless of the specific events, you can break everything into the two fundamental categories of speech and debate. The big difference there being debate, you have an opponent, versus speech, you have just sort of like competitors. In debate, you are going against one or more specific individuals who are doing their utmost to prove you wrong, to assert that their perspective on a topic is more valid than yours. And it is your job not just to defend your own perspective, but to demonstrate to the judges and anyone else listening why their side doesn't address the topic as well as yours does. In speech, you're not doing anything to dismantle anyone else's performance, and no one's doing anything to dismantle yours. You're just getting your moment in the sun to perform or speak, and your goal is to do it better than anyone else did it, which it's a little bit of an apples to oranges thing for sure, because sometimes there'll be a round with just widely different topics or widely different tones in the different performances, and the judge has to sit there and really make some tough decisions. Within the debate realm, you can kind of then break that into two main categories, what we call congressional debate, which is really just one event, which is a simulation of Congress here in the United States, where students are playing the roles of representatives and senators, and they're debating theoretical legislation that could change our country, often which has been written by the students themselves previously. The rest of the debate realm is events like Lincoln-Douglas debate, public forum debate, policy debate, where there's a specific topic that's been announced in advance, and students are preparing, they call them cases. They're preparing cases on each side of the topic, and then you don't necessarily get to choose your side. So you're going to argue both sides over the course of a tournament. You'll have multiple rounds of competition, and yeah, you're going to go back and forth. So one student will start the debate by sharing his or her case on this side of the issue, and then the other team will have a chance to share their, what they call their construct their case, and then it'll kind of go back and forth between cross-examination and rebuttals until the round's over. In speech, you can break it into two main categories as well, what we call interpretation events, which I mentioned earlier. They're very much like acting. It's students choosing sources written by professional authors, published authors. It might be an excerpt from a book. It might be a screenplay. It might be a TV show. And they're performing it without props, without costumes. It's just one or two students in the space using their body and their voices, their facial expressions to make this piece come alive. And then the other side is what we call public address, which is kind of like TED Talks. There's a variety of events in there where students, in one way or another, are sharing their thoughts on a topic or sometimes a political question.
So you have had really large amounts of success with the students that you've had in debate in getting to nationals, like that competition seems to be something that your students are involved in, a lot of national tournaments and in a lot of the schools that you've taught at. Can you take me through the process of what do your students have to do to get to that level to be able to compete on the national?
Mm-hmm. Well, it varies a little bit year by year. I mean, the actual logistics of what it takes are basically the same. To get to nationals, a student needs to perform well enough, and again, the well enough there is what where there's a lot of wiggle room, at a district qualifying tournament to earn a spot. Or for one event called World Schools Debate, they have to be selected through an application, which would be based on their track record in speech and debate. So if a student comes to that district qualifying tournament and gets first place in their event, they're going to nationals, no matter what. They've won the competition for that. They have earned a spot. But it is very much possible, and I would say actually the majority of my students who have gone to nationals haven't quite earned a spot that way. I have had students who got first place at that district tournament and won it completely outright like that. But depending on the year and a variety of factors, often a district gets to send two students to nationals in a given event, or actually in one of the Congress events, four. So, you know, I had a student qualify in New Mexico to Congress. He was fourth overall, but he earned that spot outright because there were four slots to be given away. But even if you don't earn one of those one or two or four spots outright, you are entered as an alternate if you're somewhere near the top. So for instance, my very first year coaching, I think the district qualifying tournament was only our third or fourth tournament that year. We got sort of a slow start and we didn't make it to a lot of them. And so no one was expecting nationals that year. It just seemed preposterous. We figured we'd go and have fun and give it a try. And I had, quite surprisingly, I had one kid as the second alternate in Senate. They break Congress into Senate and House. One kid was the second alternate in Senate. And then I had two kids who were like, I think they were the fifth and sixth alternates in House. And so we're like, well, maybe the Senate kid will get it. But the fifth and sixth alternates in House, that's pretty far. That means that all four kids who qualified, you know, some of them have to vacate their seats. And then we have to vacate several spots down the line for that, those kids to make it. But, you know, you never know what's going to happen. There's a variety of reasons why kids might earn a spot to nationals and not wind up going. Nationals is a week-long tournament in the middle of June at the start of summer vacation. So often families have trips planned at that time of year. Additionally, if you're a senior in high school, you've usually graduated by that point. And some kids don't want to like graduate and throw their cap in the air and then go compete in what's honestly a much more challenging academic endeavor than anything they did in high school. And then you also can only qualify in one event. So if a student qualifies in two, they have to choose which one they're going to go to. So if possible that some of those kids qualified in other events and chose those. So anyway, long story short, all three of those students wound up going to nationals that year, even though none of them were the cream of the crop necessarily. And that's not surprising. Actually, one of them went on to be, you know, one of the best students I've ever, I mean, she was already, but she went on to prove herself as one of the best students I've ever coached. She was the state and district champion and earned it outright in the years to come. But yeah, so it is kind of like, I always want to caution people from, you know, I'm very, very proud, of course, of what my students have accomplished at nationals. And it's wonderful for building these programs. Like, I think the optics of saying, hey, we are sending kids to nationals is a really great way to build investment in the program for the school and the community. But it's not always an indication that a kid is a tremendous speaker or debater yet. But even when that's the case, even when I brought kids who were like pretty, you know, they were kind of out of their depths, just the experience of being at nationals is one of the most powerful motivators and sources of inspiration for a kid to come back the next year and do the whole thing way better. When you see what students are capable of in speech and debate at that level, it really ups your game, and that spreads to the whole team. So I'm really looking forward, you know, to season two here with my current school, We had two kids at Nationals on the high school team and then two kids on the middle school team who happened to be my children. And it's going to be, I think, really beneficial in the fall for those kids to share their experience and for the whole school to realize, hey, if I take part in this team and really put my head down and my nose to the grindstone or whatever that saying is, then I could do something really cool. I could distinguish myself in some pretty unusual ways and have a really amazing opportunity.
So I want to switch a little bit, although not too much, because it is going to fit into a lot of other things related to why I have you on as our secular saint this month. You have historically questioned the patriarchy and how that works in your life. Can you explain to me how that challenge of the patriarchy on your part has made you live the life that you have in teaching and your personal life?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would expand it beyond the patriarchy and say the white supremacist hegemony more generally as well. I think it's been a long and an ongoing journey of understanding. My mom always raised me from a young age to question those sorts of realities. And I was raised primarily by her alone. So being raised by a woman on its own, I think, is a great way of challenging the patriarchy. But I think I understood it on a really superficial level for a long time. And I think I had a lot of internalized sexism and racism going, especially growing up in a place like Maine, which is, I think, maybe the second whitest state these days. It might have been the whitest when I was a kid, though. I had a lot to learn about being an ally and being sort of anti-racist in theory, but allowing biases creep through in my behaviors and my jokes. I kind of look back at some of the things I used to think were funny in college and cringe, which I imagine may be true for a lot of people. So I think as I've become an educator and as I've evolved as an educator, I've really found that to be a core part of what I believe this profession is about, by which I mean to say, like, I see education as an opportunity to help young people recognize that there's a lot of different ways to understand and think about and experience this world. Yeah, I think literature is social justice. When I pick the text that we're going to read, whether it's a full-length novel or a short story or poem, I try to really, it can be difficult depending on the resources of the school I'm at, but I try to really tick a lot of boxes in terms of course, making sure it's a book that I think my kids will be interested in, a book that I think they can access based on their skill set, but then also a book that I think is going to deepen their understanding of humanity in some core way. I know when I was at Yarmouth High, which is consistently ranked as one of the best high schools in the state of Maine, I'm trying to remember right now. I honestly struggle to think of a single book we read by a non-white author. We definitely read poems and maybe a short story here or there. And I know that there were books taught at the school by non-white authors for sure, but I don't know if it was just the happenstance of like my particular course selection and the teachers I got. But yeah, pretty much everything we read was white dudes. And that's pretty problematic. And I think that certainly didn't help the situation I was describing. So I really put a lot of effort these days to trying to expose students to different voices. And I think speech and debate can fulfill a similar function there in terms of if it's an interpretation event, helping students to consider a variety of texts for their sources. If it's a debate event, helping them to consider, I mean, honestly, it's fortunate, but you often get a real leg up in a debate if you look at the topic from the perspective of some marginalized group, because especially here in Maine, chances are you're going up against a couple of white kids who have not considered those sorts of angles. That was especially true when I was coaching at Navajo Prep, because those students were they were almost all Indigenous and majority Navajo. And of course, by default, a lot of those kids would look at the topics from an Indigenous perspective. And then we'd ride down to Albuquerque and they would go into rounds against, actually, they would, the competitors in Albuquerque were fairly diverse, but there weren't many indigenous students. There was a lot, there were plenty of white kids. And then there was a large South Asian contingent, East Asian. And they'd start talking about the way this impacts people on the reservation or water rights or something like that. And the kids would be totally unprepared because they had never really thought about that sort of situation before. So yeah, I guess I really see education as an opportunity to sort of, I don't want to say plant the seeds, because that makes it sound like the conservatives are right, that we're all indoctrinating these kids, but just to open students' minds and to allow them to consider the world in ways that they might otherwise not have.
But you make a good point too, in that debate aspect. It's not so much indoctrination as just introduction to other points of view, mm-hmm. that then opens you up. I think just being introduced to something that's outside of your four walls can be helpful.
Oh yeah. It's can be really transformative. And again, like, it's especially, I don't think I've ever quite worked at as insulated a place as I do now. The town where I teach, Sullivan, is 20 miles east of Ellsworth, which is the gateway to Acadia National Park. Ellsworth itself is a hike from sort of the population center of Maine. So, you know, we're then another 20, 25 minutes towards Canada, up the coast, what they call Down East Maine. The Bold Coast is a little past us. These are fishing communities, lobstering communities, the recently dethroned Graham Plattner, oysterman. This is his community, literally. He's from the town where I teach. And many of these kids have never been to Portland, let alone left the state, let alone gotten on a plane. They've spent their whole lives in the few communities surrounding where they are, you know, right in my classroom. And for many of them, that may never change. They're raised by parents who have barely left. And not that there's anything, I'm not saying that's a problem inherently. I think there's something beautiful about living your whole life and with a kind of commitment to a certain area, although I think often it's not by choice. It's not entirely, but that doesn't mean, actually, I'm a big fan of Taoism. And there's one of my favorite poems from the Tao Te Ching has a line like, without going out of my door, I can know all ways of heaven. And it's the idea that, like, you don't need to actually travel to understand the world. And I don't know exactly, you know, I assume the ancient Chinese poet there wasn't referring necessarily to reading lots of books. I think it's probably a more mystical, meditative thing. But I like to read that as, you can experience art, you can read books, you can watch movies, you can do things that will allow you to understand the world much, much better, even if you don't have the means to travel or the interest to travel.
So along with that, I'm kind of backtracking slightly to the curriculum you have. So in your classroom, what is your policy for the books that you choose? Because I understand that it's slightly outside of what you mentioned earlier. You had at Yarmouth, where you had virtually all white male authors as your texts, but you've taken a different path from my understanding.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's an out and out policy necessarily, but I guess when I'm choosing books, when I'm choosing texts to read, well, first of all, I would also point out that it's going to be dependent on the students who are in front of me. So, you know, what this looked like at Navajo Prep obviously was quite different than what it looks like at Sumner. I think in both cases, it's important to shake up the canon, as we like to call it, to move away from this mode where we only read these classics of world literature, of Anglophone literature, of American literature. I think for a place like Navajo Prep, it's important for students to be able to see themselves in literature, whether we're literally reading something by a Navajo author or just recognizing that non-white people generally absolutely have a place in the literary world, and honestly have often, I think, done a lot of the most important things with our literary movements as a country and as a species. Whereas at a place like Sumner, where, and we do have a not totally insignificant non-white population at the school. There's actually a decent number of Latino students in the area who've mostly come up here over the years to help with the blueberry crop. We've right on the edge here of the largest blueberry growing region in the country. For those students, though, the white ones, the majority white students, again, it's the importance of like having an opportunity to get out of their own mindset and see the world through the eyes of someone who's been historically marginalized, who's had a life that's been challenging for different reasons, at the least. When I'm selecting texts, again, I always kind of have to start with the questions of accessibility, because, you know, I would love to teach Invisible Man, Ralph Ellison, but unless I'm teaching AP Literature, unless I'm teaching, a really advanced lit course, I just know I'm going to be pulling students through that book because it's so long, it's so sort of narratively experimental. So I've got to find something that's accessible. I've got to find something that's a decent length. I don't want to spend a half a year on one book. I want to be able to move in a few different directions over the course of the year. But then once I've found some choices in that respect, then I'm thinking about what's a text I can choose that's going to not just help these kids think about theme and learn how to do MLA format when they write an essay about it and tick the literal boxes that we need to from a perspective of credit and mastery and graduation requirements and all that stuff. But what's also going to add something to their lives in terms of helping them understand the world from a new perspective, to have it add a new dimension to how they conceive of humanity. So it doesn't mean that we never read books by white male authors. I'm a big advocate for Shakespeare. I do think Shakespeare continues to have a really important, or should continue to have a really important role in American high school education. I taught Catcher in the Rye last year, but I'm going to do my best to make sure most, if not all, of the books that kids encounter are by authors who have been disadvantaged in one way or another, whether it's a Black author or a female author or a neurodivergent author or something like that.
Well, I like the fact that you almost bring up the two parts of this, of what are you seeing in your literature? And there's that seeing other people that are outside of your normal frame of vision, but also, and just as importantly, that seeing yourself represented in literature. And it seems like right now we have a lot of people attacking books. I think it feels to me like we're at an all-time high of censorship challenges. Even in my small community of Fishers, Indiana, we had major censorship issues at our public library. And it tends to be directed at these books that allow people to see themselves. So what are some of the texts that you recommend or that you're teaching, and how does it fit into that?
Well, the one that comes to mind most immediately is Bless Me Ultima by Rudolfo Anaya, which is a classic of New Mexico literature. It's funny enough, I was talking about how I didn't read anything by non-white authors when I was a student. I know there was another English class at my school. I think it was actually I took honors and AP everything. I was always trying to push myself in that way. But I had friends, I think it was my ninth grade year, in the non-honors English class who read that book. And I remember being like, why are they reading that? That sounds kind of interesting. Like, we're over here reading, I don't remember what we were reading, Romeo and Juliet or something. And I was like, what's this Bless Me Ultima? But I never made the time to read it then, or through most of my adulthood. It wasn't until we moved to New Mexico. And I was like, oh, this book is like a serious entity here in New Mexico. I should read it. So I finally read it and I really enjoyed it. And this was around the time that a lot of the post George Floyd blowback against some of the canon had taken root. And one of the texts that had come under a lot of scrutiny was To Kill a Mockingbird, which is, you know, probably one of the most common texts to read, to be assigned in high school. And I love To Kill a Mockingbird. I think it's a wonderful novel. I think it does have issues. I think its biggest issue isn't its own fault necessarily. I think Harper Lee admitted herself that she didn't write this book to sort of become the centerpiece of a like civil rights literary curriculum. She's very honest about the fact that it was, you know, one young girl's perspective of all this. But if you really want to understand the issues, then reading something from the perspective of, forgetting the young man's name who was accused of the murder in that book, But anyway, from a Black person's perspective, would it be a much more powerful way to do that? So I found myself, because I think one of the things that's so appealing, in addition to the fact that it theoretically allows teachers to talk a little bit about social justice and history of racism and civil rights, one of the things that's so appealing about To Kill a Mockingbird is that coming of age, young child's perspective, a kid starting to learn that the world is a much scarier and more complex place than they realized, and struggling to make sense of that. I was like, that's compelling, right? Kids who are in high school are going through that in real time. Like, it, obviously there's value to teaching books where that happens. And so right around that time, I read Bless Me Ultima, and I was like, oh, Bless Me Ultima is like kind of the perfect book to replace To Kill a Mockingbird with in a lot of curriculums, because it's written by a non-white person. It's, for people who haven't read it, it's about a young Chicano boy growing up in New Mexico at the end of World War II. Again, starting to learn that there's a lot of anger and hate and violence in the world, and that he's from a Catholic family, and he's really struggling to understand how his Catholicism fits into all this and whether it really actually even can address the concerns he's beginning to have. It's a wonderful book. Highly recommend it. So I haven't taught To Kill a Mockingbird since the pandemic for a variety of reasons, but nowadays, if I had To Kill a Mockingbird on the shelf and Bless Me Ultima on the shelf, I would grab Bless Me Ultima every single time. So I just taught that this past spring. But one of the sort of interesting dynamics of teaching that is, again, one of the things that appealed to me about it was that it's a Latino author. And I do have Latino students, not a bunch, but I have some. But it was a real delicate sort of tightrope walk to teach that when you've got a class of, say, 12 or 13 white kids and then one or two Latino kids in the room, and you're reading that. And Rudolfo Anaya, the author, he uses a lot of Spanish in the book. And some of it, I don't speak Spanish myself, but I'm, you know, vaguely familiar with a lot of Spanish. But sometimes we'd come across a word that seemed fairly, you know, often you don't need to know the Spanish to understand it. But sometimes a word would seem kind of important, and it'd be like, what does that word mean? I'm like, oh, I'm not sure. And it was really tough to keep them from being like, oh, hey, you know, Jimmy, and turn to the one Latino kid and be like, what's this mean? And maybe Jimmy knows, maybe Jimmy doesn't know, but obviously it shouldn't be Jimmy's responsibility to translate for us. We should experience this book any differently than anyone else does if they don't want to. But it is a part of the country where politically there's not always a lot of positive feeling toward Latino people in general and immigrants. So it could be tricky. And that doesn't mean that it's not, it was well worth it. Nevertheless, I think it was valuable to have that text in our classroom. But it's not an easy job for a lot of reasons, and that's one of them. So yeah, Bless Me Ultima is one that I've taught a lot. I taught last year Braiding Sweetgrass in a composition course by Robin Wall Kimmerer. Braiding Sweetgrass, that's a collection of essays written by an indigenous botanist that kids really connected with. It, you know, sort of finds all these connections between Western science and indigenous wisdom, and presents a lot of, I think, really just calming and grounding ways to look at the world and to engage with nature. That's a long book. That was, again, that was for like a college credit composition course. So those kids were a little more willing to take something on like that, but they really seemed to enjoy it. At Navajo Prep, probably the most successful non-canon book I taught was Ceremony by Leslie Marmon Silko. But even that's nowadays kind of in the canon itself, because it's such a monumental work of indigenous literature. It came out in the late 70s. It's about a Laguna Pueblo, well, he's actually half white, half Laguna Pueblo, World War II vet who comes back to the res and is deeply traumatized by what he saw in the Pacific and is trying to make sense of life and put the pieces back together. I really enjoyed teaching that at Navajo Prep because I almost didn't teach it at all. I read that in college and really struggled with it. I had a hard time understanding it. It's the narrative jumps all over the place. The perspectives change. And I just found it really hard to understand and wrap my head around. But there's a whole set of data about how much prior knowledge matters when a student is reading a book. And that, I don't think I've ever seen that in real time as much as when I taught that to my students in New Mexico for the first time. Because these sophomores in high school, many of whom had some not insignificant reading deficiencies. You know, some of them are reading at a middle school level. They were understanding this book better than I did as a college lit major. And I think it was just because they had so much to latch on to, the place names and the tribes and just sort of like the experience of the desert Southwest, the high desert. So that was pretty cool. I always enjoyed teaching that one. So, yeah, I mean, I've got lists and lists, but those are some of the big ones.
As you do when you've been teaching for a while, you have books that you have enjoyed reading yourself and books that you've enjoyed teaching. And there is a thing to that. I want to change gears completely here and step back to the time that you had in the Peace Corps. So I know you had some years in the Peace Corps after you graduated high school and I assume college as well.
Yes. Yeah. It was after college.
So tell me about your experience with the Peace Corps. Did you enjoy it and would you recommend it or?
Oh yeah. No, I loved it and I would recommend it to anyone with, I always had to have to add the caveat, a sense of adventure. Because it is a tough experience for many people, myself included. It was tough for me at many points. It's long. It's different now than it was for me, though. I don't think you need to be quite as adventurous, not to toot my own horn or anything. But I don't think you need to be quite as adventurous and sort of just like, there was a sort of a element of submission when I did it. And I think the best way to illustrate that, when I was in college, I studied abroad in Egypt for a semester. And I had a really good friend there who was really into Arabic studies and Arabic language. And after college, he applied for Peace Corps too. And in his recruitment interview, he was talking to the recruiter and he was like, well, I only want to go to an Arabic speaking country. And they said, all right, see you later. They basically like ended the interview there. And they said, that's not what this is about. Like, this is not about you going where you want to go. This is about you offering your services to the United States Peace Corps and us putting you where you can best help people. And that was kind of exciting to me. I had a desire to go to sub-Saharan Africa. I became interested in Peace Corps actually through literature. One of my favorite authors in high school is a guy named Paul Theroux. He's a Massachusetts author. He writes novels. He's probably more famous for his travel writing. But he was a very early Peace Corps volunteer. He joined the Peace Corps just a few years after Kennedy founded it in the 60s and served in Malawi, which is in sub-Saharan Africa. And I wanted to live that experience. I was like, wow, that'd be so cool. You know, rural Africa, you know, how neat would that be? And I studied French in high school, and I was basically told that being able to speak French, high school and college, I was told being able to speak French was basically a guarantee you were going to wind up in Africa. Didn't turn out that way. There were a few places I really didn't want to go. Like, I didn't really want to go to Eastern Europe. That seemed like too far from my conceptualization of Peace Corps. But I was generally like, you know, if they send me to Fiji or they send me to Nepal or to Paraguay, you know, wherever they send me, I'll be happy. And they wound up sending me to Mongolia, which honestly, I don't think I'd even realized Mongolia was an option when I applied, but I probably would have hoped for it more if I had, because I have this fascination for like really cold, remote places, probably something about being from Maine. And like, I was always very intrigued by the history of the Mongol Empire. So when I found out I was going to Mongolia, I was actually really excited. It was 2 years. It was cold and the food in Mongolia is not Mongolian barbecue. That's Taiwanese invention, actually. Real Mongolian food is, I don't say this to attack the cuisine, but it's what many people would consider bland. They're not really into spices generally. It's a lot of boiled meats and dumplings and stuff like that. There were challenges in that respect, but the people are incredibly warm and welcoming. They, by and large, loved Peace Corps volunteers who were there. They were eager to work with us. Very hospitable, fascinating culture, beautiful landscape. So yeah, and the group that I was there with, there were 74 of us in my cohort. You know, some of my absolute lifelong best friendships were forged then, including that's how I met my wife. My wife and I talk about when our kids are all grown up and out of the house, maybe doing it again, because it was just such a, again, challenging. There were times during Peace Corps where we were like trying to figure out how to get out of it. But by and large, especially looking back on it, it's something that we really are glad we did.
That's an interesting thing that makes me ask questions about it, because I was in the military, so I know there are very strict restrictions on who can join and all that. Like, I think even my son, who's in his mid-30s, is beyond the time where they would accept him into the military, if I remember from my recruiting days. But you say you've talked to your wife about going back into the Peace Corps. What are the restrictions? Or that seems impossible to me, but it sounds like it isn't.
No, yeah, a lot of people are surprised by that. They actually want more people who are later in life to be doing Peace Corps. It is sort of like the stereotype of a Peace Corps volunteer is fresh out of college, right? But a lot of people you work with are kind of disappointed by that fact. Like, I remember showing up at my school where I was going to work for 2 years, and my job title was English teacher trainer. I had had some experience with studying pedagogy and teaching in different ways in college and high school. And so that was enough to elevate me beyond just English teacher to English teacher trainer. So I was sent to a large high school. There was an English department of 7 or 8 teachers. And I wasn't going to be teaching students directly so much. I was going to be working with those teachers to try to increase their capacity. And so, I get there, and these teachers are all women in their, I think the youngest one was in her late 20s. Most of these women are in their 30s or 40s or 50s. They've been teaching for decades in some situations. They've got families at home. And this 23-year-old kid shows up, and they're like, you're going to teach us how to be better teachers? Like, well, you're so young. Like, what's the big idea here? And they really do want, I mean, they want those volunteers too. I think there's a lot of energy and excitement that a young volunteer can bring. But there is no upper age limit. I think the record currently for oldest volunteer was a woman in her early 90s or something who served in South America or something like that. But yeah, we had volunteers in that cohort of 74. I think our eldest was a woman in her late 60s or early 70s, but we had several people who were over 40 and over 50. And yeah, as long as the only thing that, and again, things have changed a little bit. Oh yeah. So I never finished that point. Nowadays, when you apply for the Peace Corps, you apply for a specific country and a specific job in that country. You don't just apply generally. I was actually one of my students from Navajo Prep. He's just finished his second year at college. He really wants to do the Peace Corps in 2 years after he graduates. And I was talking to him, and he's like, yeah, I was looking at this program in Burundi, and I was looking at this one in Thailand. And I was like, that's so weird that you can just like pick and choose now. Cause that was it. But I think honestly, especially after the pandemic, I think recruitment really took a hit. And so I think they're finding that if they allow people to have a little more control over where they go, that can help with that. But they really encourage people with a little more life experience to apply. Oh, and the only thing that can really prevent you from getting in, as long as you have the actual skill set that they want for that position, is if there's more significant health issues, they get uncomfortable about that, I guess is the best way to put it. They worry that if they're going to send you to rural Namibia and you've got such and such a medical condition, that it's going to be too difficult for them to provide the medical care you need in an emergency. But again, I think in the modern Peace Corps, that might be a little easier because there are a lot of assignments in major cities that are either near state-of-the-art medical facilities or near an airport that can get you to a state-of-the-art medical facility quickly. So I don't even know today to what degree those sorts of medical issues are as much of an obstacle as they used to be. You should consider it.
Well, I wondered about that. I thought I'd heard that if you had ever served in the military, that was a no-go for the Peace Corps. Like, you can't cross over and do the Peace Corps if you served in the military.
Yeah, no, one of our best friends there was a vet. He served in the Gulf War.
See, so you've taught me something that I didn't know, and I would absolutely consider it. I think it would be a fascinating world experience. I've actually considered teaching for the military overseas because I enjoyed the time that I lived overseas when I was in the military, and I think that would be a good thing to re-experience. And I going back to the idea way, way back of being in a place where the student population hasn't seen anything outside of their small little area, just to be able to travel in general, I think, is important for anybody. And being able to get outside the country in particular, I think, is very important. Just even if you're on vacation, it'll get you something. But to live and breathe that lifestyle for a while is tremendous. It made a world of difference in my worldview by living in even the places that I lived. England and Italy are not all that different, but it was a life-changing experience for me.
Yep.
I appreciate you coming on the program. I have been fascinated with all the things you talked about. I loved your take on how your personal experience with speech and debate in high school motivated you to take it on as a coach, because I know with my children, my middle child, Jenny, was in marching band, and that was a very big group of people that tended to hold together really well. And I have the feeling that the speech and debate teams hold together really well. So to take that passion that you had in high school and be able to bring that into what you did as a teacher of high school, I think is fantastic. And even though it sounded like you were just kind of dropped into it at Yarmouth, it's like, oh, wait a minute. He used to do this. He can do it again. I thought that was really fascinating. But I appreciate your perspective. The idea on the Peace Corps, the readings that your students are doing, I think is all fantastic. And I'm really pleased that we were able to bring you on. I do want to bring up one other point that I don't want to forget. So you mentioned the influence that your mother had on you and raising you mainly as a single parent and all that. I think it's important to point out that your mother is the former co-host of the Sacred Legions podcast, Pat LaMarche. Mm-hmm. And I also want to make the point that doing this interview has nothing to do with your mother being involved in the podcast before, other than I listen to what your mother's recommendations are on a lot of people. A lot of the guests that I've had have been a result of your mother's worldview and world experience. She has been involved in so many wonderful things, mm-hmm. from running for vice president in the 2004 election and being a radio broadcaster and being a journalist and being a very socially conscious person. There is no doubt in my mind that in the future, I will be interviewing your mother as a secular saint, because there's no question that she fits into that category with many of the things she does. And it's nice for me to see that the passion that she had for that secular sainthood has carried over to her children. And so that's made this a particularly nice interview for me to have. And I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Sacred Legions, hosted by Max Goler. Original music by Jamie Callan. To hear archived episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service. You will learn more about people behaving decently in indecent times and about the nonprofit organizations they support. Don't forget to check out our merchandise shop. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions, LLC.